Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Steve Inskeep, co-host of NPR's Morning Edition, has made a number of reporting trips to Pakistan over the last decade. His new book about Karachi is called Instant City. The population has swelled to 13 million people since the end of World War II, when it was home to just 400,000 people. He describes a crowded, chaotic, and unruly place where residents fight over land and power and money. He also focuses on the bombing of a Shia religious procession on December 2009 and how it highlights the conflicts, the complexities, and even the creativity in Karachi. Steve Inskeep joins us from the NPR studios in Washington, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times, and congratulations on your book.
Oh, thanks so much. And this is one of the high points, being on Radio Times. It's great to get the
invitation. Well, I certainly appreciate that. Can you describe Karachi for us? I've been to New York City, as many people have, a city of about 8 million people. Karachi, perhaps even more than 13 million people. How do you describe a city of that size?
Well, you arrive at the airport and you immediately realize that it's an unusual place because you see these massive green and white ads that are pretty new, actually, saying that they're advertising a Pakistan's first Sharia-compliant credit card. So you have immediately some of the contrast between the religious and the commercial in this place. You drive in through the city. It's massive. You go past military bases. You go past huge apartment complexes. You go past these unauthorized neighborhoods in which millions of people live in homes on land that was basically seized from the government that they don't really own. But you end up near the waterfront looking at new glass towers, Dubai style, new restaurants, new stores. It's a city of incredible contrast from high to low.
And a city, as I said in the intro, borrowing from your book, that after World War II was a city of 350 to 400,000 people. Mm-hmm. What drew so many people to Karachi?
Well, a lot of it is global, and that's one of the things I wanted to get across here. There has been this massive global move to cities of 2.7 billion or something like that, and we're just hearing today that the United Nations is declaring the world population to be 7 billion, give or take a few million.
Exactly.
But more than half of that is in cities, and that has never happened before in human history, and so I wanted to illustrate that in just one place. Now, in Karachi, the massive growth began in a special way. There was the division of Pakistan and India in 1947. One country majority Hindu, the other country majority Muslim. There were millions of people who found themselves on the wrong side of the dividing lines, Muslims and Hindus. Millions fled. Many were killed. Hundreds of thousands of Muslim refugees ended up in Karachi, which went from that few hundred thousand to way over a million in the space of a few years and continued growing. But this is actually normal. There are human catastrophes that have caused cities to grow, people to become refugees, and also economic opportunities that have caused cities to grow as people go from poor villages in the countryside and seek a job in the city that seems awful to us, $3 or $4 or $5 a day maybe, but it's better than what they had.
This was a better life that they found in this sprawling urban metropolis?
Yeah, but I don't want to minimize the problems. This is a place of optimism. It is a place of progress. That's the reason it grows. But that progress comes at an awful human cost. And it's progress on average. The average person is better off in Karachi, according to UN statistics, than they would be in the countryside. And that's normal for cities. We shouldn't feel too bad about cities. But there's massive pollution. There is chaos a lot of the times. There is a lack of law and order. People come to this city for education, which is great, and they are by and large more literate than in the countryside. And yet just earlier this month, I was in Karachi visiting schools that are closed and have been closed for months or even years because of violence in the neighborhood.
And you also say a lot of the conflict is over land, and I'm assuming scarce land fighting over pieces, sort of turf of Karachi.
And this is one of the ways that I think that a city that might seem really unusual and unfamiliar to us can actually begin to seem familiar, because we all obsess about land, don't we?
Sure.
And real estate in one way or another. We're thinking about our home values. We're thinking about the people across the street and whether they keep up the home. We're thinking about who's moving in. We're thinking about old timers and newcomers in our neighborhood, or the developer who wants to build something at the end of the block. And the same kinds of things happen in a place like Karachi, or many other cities around the world. If we're talking about Istanbul or Sao Paulo, the same kinds of things happen, but they so often happen outside the realm of rules, outside the realm of law. And you do have people who simply seize property, subdivide it, pay the police to look the other way, and build homes. And if they get into a conflict over who should really be possessing that land, a lot of people can end up killed.
Is this a governable city of 13 million, as you describe it, Steve Inskeep?
Well, it's interesting you mention that, Marty. I spent some time with a man who was, for a little more than four years, the mayor of Karachi, Mustafa Kemal, the Nazim of the city district government, as he's called locally. And he's a very energetic man who won wide praise for building infrastructure, for improving highways, for digging sewers, for digging water lines, that sort of thing. And as a matter of fact, as I was moving about, there was a local official who sidled up to me as I was following Kemal about and gestured toward him and said, he's the Rudy Giuliani of Karachi, meaning this is the guy who can govern the city that was previously seen to be ungovernable. But I want to tell you that Kemal is connected to a controversial political party that's blamed for having a role in the ethnic warfare in the city. And I also want to tell you the man is out of office because there's been a political crisis in the city so grave, a dispute between the leading political parties so grave that they can't agree on a local government law, and there actually is no mayor at the moment.
Wow. Your book focuses on several violent attacks. One of them is in December 29th, as a matter of fact, 2009. There's a Shia religious procession in a part of Karachi. What happened?
Yeah, on that day, December 28, 2009, there was this march going down the center of the city, right near the old city hall in Karachi. We're in the old section of the city, which is really quite beautiful, although somewhat decayed, old British-era colonial buildings and so forth, South Asian onion-shaped domes. And it was in this delightful setting that a bomb went off and killed a large number of people. This Shia religious minority, and Shias are a minority in Pakistan, was targeted. A large number of people were killed, and it was actually only the beginning of a day of violence. A short time later, a large number of men appeared on the street. There's controversy even today about who they were or what their motives were. And they set a large number of shops on fire. In fact, hundreds of wholesale shops and warehouses were destroyed. A large number of blocks of the city were torched or buildings were even burned to the ground. And to me, that sequence of events lights up a number of the conflicts of a city like this. This is a place where lots of different people come together, and you see incredible contrasts and conflicts between ancient and modern, between global forces and local forces, different religious groups. And there's such religious diversity in Karachi even today, even though it is overwhelmingly Muslim. There are other religious minorities and many divisions within Islam itself. And you also see divisions, by the way, Marty, between rich and poor. I mean, there's been so much discussion in this country in the last couple of months about income inequality. That is something that you find around the world, and it is spectacularly on display in a place like Karachi.
Oftentimes when we hear about violence in this part of the world, we think it has to do with, you know, U.S. policy. And you make very clear in this book that this is about internal conflicts within a city, within a country, within perhaps even a religion.
Yeah, I think that we misunderstand a lot of the world if we think it's all about us. And it's not that we're not involved. And in fact, the United States has been intermittently involved in Pakistan for decades. I go back in my research to the 1940s, and I find that within a few years after Pakistan's independence in 1947, the United States is getting involved with Pakistan's military in ways that have not proved to be all that productive. And a lot of American officials would agree with that. So we're involved, we're engaged, we're sometimes responsible, and we're often quite tragically the targets of attacks. And yet, on some other level, the conflict is not necessarily about the West. We misconstrue it if we think it's Islam versus the West. Often what's happening is Muslims killing Muslims, Muslims arguing or fighting with Muslims over what the Islamic world should be. And this is a battle in which Westerners may well have allies as well as enemies.
Well, as you were describing, this was an attack, a violent attack in December 2009, and then in February 2010, another attack. And then even after that, an attack in a hospital where people obviously are going to be treated.
Yeah, this is all part of a series of attacks that were connected. One religious procession was bombed in December 2009. There was a related procession 40 days later, also bombed. The wounded were taken to a hospital called the Jinnah Postgraduate Medical Center. And it's a sad story, but in some ways inspiring, Marty, because there was a bomb that exploded outside the hospital. Not only that, there was another bomb that was set outside the hospital. A number of people were killed right there at the emergency department. The windows of the building were blown out and the glass in the doors. Doctors were injured. The director of the emergency department, Dr. Seaman Jamali, who I interviewed for the book, was knocked down by this explosion and was nearly trampled in the panic as people ran different ways. There were hundreds of people crowding the emergency department at that moment, not just victims and doctors and nurses, but the families of the victims had crowded the area, and there was panic. And yet, what is really characteristic of a place like this, and I think it's true of a lot of large cities, is that life went on. And in this case, Dr. Jamali and her colleagues in this emergency department actually had the emergency department up, running, reopened within 24 hours of the bombing.
I mean, does that tell you that people just, I mean, there's urban violence around the world. Frankly, there's violence around the world. And in many ways, U.S. is a violent country. But this seems like a different kind of violence. Do people just figure out how to live with it and around it?
Well, this is a situation where people are struggling to live without a lot of faith that the government is going to protect them or know what to do, and without necessarily a lot of agreement about what the social contract is. I'm writing here about a country where there's been dispute for decades, going back to 1947, about what Pakistan is really supposed to stand for. How is religion supposed to relate to the state? How are different kinds of people supposed to get along? Now, the founder of the country, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, in 1947, actually gave an inspiring speech in which he said that he wanted his fellow citizens to treat each other as equals, regardless of color, caste, or creed. An impressive statement to make in 1947. Even in America, it would have been quite impressive. But that's not something that a lot of his countrymen have necessarily followed. And in fact, that's been one of the great conflicts of this country and of large parts of the world, frankly. How do you treat your fellow citizens when they're different? And those differences become very evident when you go to a large, large city.
And that's Steve Inskeep, our guest today on Radio Times, a co-host of NPR's Morning Edition and author of a new book. It's called Instant City: Life and Death in Karachi. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
WHYY programming is supported by the teachers and education support professionals of the Pennsylvania State Education Association, educating all children for a bright future. We are PSEA, providing the power of a great education.
The Wistar Institute is proud to support WHYY-FM. I'm Dr. Russell Kaufman, president of the Wistar Institute, a world leader in biomedical research right here in Philadelphia. Today at Wistar, scientists can explore our entire set of genes to answer the question, what causes cancer? This research guides us to design individual therapies for different types of cancer. The Wistar Institute, today's discoveries, tomorrow's cures, online at wistar.org.
Newsworks.org is your source for smart stories that keep you better informed, better connected, and better prepared. Our network of quality journalists is a step above the rest, and better coverage of important issues means you'll always be a step ahead. NewsWorks is something different. News for people who ask more. News for people who care, by people who care. Get involved at newsworks.org. NewsWorks is, simply, news that works. Powered by WHYY and you.
I'm Mike and Scott. Join us for the next WHYY Parenting Seminar when we'll discuss healthy nutrition for kids and families. Tuesday, November 8th at 6:30 here at WHYY. To register, visit whyy.org/member experience.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with NPR's Morning Edition co-host Steve Inskeep about a city in Pakistan that he calls an instant city. It's Karachi. The book is called Instant City, Life and Death in Karachi. He says we're living in the age of the instant city and cities like Karachi around the world. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I was multitasking here and talking at the same time. Always a dangerous thing to do. Let me read a review. Akbar Ahmed, he reviewed your book, and this is what he said about his Karachi. He said, "The Karachi of my childhood has changed. Its beaches are destroyed. Its elegant old houses have been converted into ugly high-rise apartment buildings, and its open spaces have been sold by corrupt government officials to developers. The city is mired in violence of every kind, ethnic, political, and sectarian. Its administration is broken, and its politicians are seen as corrupt. But Karachi has a big, courageous, and even generous heart. The vitality and resolve of its remarkable citizens remain undimmed." Do you agree with that, Stevens Keith?
I think by and large, yes. That's Akbar S. Ahmed in the Washington Post. He's a distinguished scholar of Islam, and yeah. He's one of these migrants who made the city once upon a time. He was brought to the city as a boy in the 1940s, so he knows this experience firsthand. I mean, this is a city where everything shuts down for days in an outrageous way because of ethnic gun battles. Dozens of people will be killed on the streets. And it's a strange place to visit, Marty, because I can't even tell you with absolute certainty who the contending sides are or what their motivations are necessarily. We know that there are large political parties that are linked with ethnic and language groups and that they have been fighting for years. But whether that's the cause of any one killing or whether it's a local business dispute, you never find out. You just know that the city shuts down. But you also know that after a few days of businesses being closed and kids not getting to go to school and things really, really seeming awful, that the city comes back to life again in this way that has got to have a terrible, terrible long-term cost, but that people still manage to do.
But if Karachi is a city of 13 plus million today, but imagining in 10 years, if this were a city of, let's say, 20 million, is there any chance that it could, in a sense, figure out how to be a more stable place?
I think that there are possibilities. Pakistan, the country to which it's attached, has grave problems that sort of get magnified in Karachi because, like so many cities, it takes in migrants. It's taken in people from all over the country and, in fact, all over the subcontinent of South Asia. You know, the statement that people survive and get to the next day, I mean, that's hopeful in a way. I mean, that's why the picture on the cover of the book are some guys that are riding a motorcycle past a couple of burning buses, and they appear to not even be paying that much attention. They're going about their business. But you want more. I think that there is cause for dismay in a great many of our growing cities around the world. Many of them are such awful places to live. They're such sources of pollution. They're sources of the gases that are linked to global warming. They are sometimes sources of violence. There are troubles in cities. But when you read someone like the urban writer Jane Jacobs, who's been so influential talking about cities and how they change and how they grow, she argues that cities are also sources of innovation, that problems created in cities often are solved by the people in cities. And if you just think about the simple question of how to feed people in cities, she argues that one of the reasons that cities have been able to grow so big in the first place, one of the reasons that we're able to support 7 billion people, according to the United Nations, is that people in cities came up with innovative technologies, which they were then able to export out into the countryside, and innovative techniques, which they sent out into the countryside, which made agriculture more productive. So you can hope that over time that cities can take advantage of some of their inherent advantages. This is a place where different kinds of people can come together. That can be dangerous, but can also mean they share ideas. This is a place where people of different faiths can come together, and there have been periods, even in a city like Karachi, where people are able to do that. This is a place where people can get educated, can find jobs, can find a better life for their families. And so, on average, these cities are better than the alternative, and you can hope that the terrible disadvantages can be cleaned up or at least mitigated in some cities over time.
In fact, you say looking at cities like Karachi, they have to figure out how to embrace that religious diversity and also have to have a free press that obviously challenges the power structure and can in a sense either write or discuss what's going on within that city, those city limits.
Yeah, and that's one of the ways that one of the things that's worth underlining. I mean, if you travel around the developing world, you run into surprises. And one of them is that actually there's been a lot of progress in the area of a free press in Pakistan in the last decade. The last military ruler, Pervez Musharraf, whatever you think of him, did free up cable TV licenses. There was really only one TV channel before in Pakistan, state TV. Now there are said to be something like 100 channels in I don't know how many languages, and there are several news channels, all news channels in several languages, including English. There are many newspapers, even more perhaps than there were a decade ago, and there is a lively debate in that country, which is all to the good, or almost all to the good, except for two things. Some of it is virulently irresponsible. There's a lot of stuff that is reported that is simply not supported by facts. Mm. And also there are things missing. It's a selective debate, especially in a place like Karachi, where writing the wrong thing can get you killed. By someone inside the government or by someone in a political party or someone in a militant group, or you could be threatened by all of them at once. And so reporters, even really courageous ones, and there are many who are courageous, have to be very careful and selective about what they write. They leave stuff out.
Are there conspiracy theories? Is it a place rich for conspiracy theories?
Oh, my goodness, yeah. And when I talked about irresponsible reporting, I mean, and I don't think I'm saying anything that a lot of Pakistanis wouldn't agree with. I mean, there are things that you can read in the paper or see on television that just don't seem to be supported by the facts. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite examples came when I was in Pakistan last spring. This was after Osama bin Laden was killed. And of course, that was a very distressing event for a lot of Pakistanis, even those who approved of the killing of bin Laden, the fact that there was an American raid on their territory. After that, there was, in the city of Karachi, an attack on a naval base. And this group of militants destroyed a number of planes there. There was a serving military officer who wrote an article under his own name in the newspaper, in Pakistan, in a newspaper, stating his theory, laying out his theory that perhaps this attack on the naval base was organized by the United States as a part of a grand plot to weaken Pakistan in preparation for seizing Pakistan's nuclear weapons. And there are lots of conspiracy theories like that. Now, I'm a reporter. I'll keep an open mind. But I haven't seen any evidence that the United States, which is spending billions of dollars to try to stabilize Pakistan, is simultaneously engaged in conspiracies to tear it down. But this is a large part of the discussion there, which is a large part of the reason that there is anti-Americanism in Pakistan.
And that's Steve Inskeep, our guest today on Radio Times, a familiar voice to those of you listening to NPR's Morning Edition, co-host of Morning Edition and author of a new book called Instant City, Life and Death in Karachi. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I'm interested in your very first trip to Karachi and what your first impression was.
I didn't like it.
You didn't like it? For all the things we've been talking about?
I'll confess. No, I mean, I just didn't understand it. And it was a large and scary place. I went and covered, Marty, the war in Afghanistan for NPR in 2001 and 2002 after 9/11. And I just kind of passed through Pakistan on my way there, but then was assigned to spend some time in Pakistan reporting. And the very first place that I landed was Karachi, and the very first story that I was supposed to cover was court proceedings relating to the killing of Daniel Pearl, the Wall Street Journal reporter, who'd gone and tried to find militant groups and make contact with militant groups in Karachi and was kidnapped and killed in 2002. So that wasn't a very welcoming opening to the city, and it just seemed very large, very dangerous, and hard even to cross the street. Forget about militants. I mean, you could get killed crossing the street in Karachi if you don't know what you're doing. But I did a few more stories there and became intrigued by the people. The tragedy of it to a great degree, and also just the survivalism of the people. Mm-hmm. And also I began to be interested in the physical landscape and the way that it was changing. When you go around the center of the city, you see these huge old stone buildings in this overwhelmingly Muslim city that look like churches. One of them is actually a big public meeting hall. Some of them actually are churches. There's a Christian minority even today in Karachi. You see these grand old buildings that mix European and South Asian architecture, which last from the British colonial times. Then you see other buildings that are more 1960s, 1980s vintage hotels and so forth. And then beyond that, there is this vast suburban expansion spreading over hundreds and hundreds of square miles, these thousands, if not millions, of simple concrete homes, concrete block homes that are being built so quickly in so much of the city. And this is where millions of people are living. And the city has changed so much that I think that if someone was there 40 years ago, went away and came back, they'd hardly recognize the city anymore.
Well, I have to say, I was thinking about Daniel Pearl as I was reading your book, of course, knowing what happened to him in Karachi. And I'm just curious about the kinds of precautions that you took. Obviously, once you get to know a place and how it operates and perhaps who some of the factions are that might help to keep you safe. But at the same time, it's a volatile situation.
It's a volatile situation. You know, I don't want to overstate it. I mean, I have covered probably more dangerous situations, mm-hmm. and I have colleagues who've covered far more dangerous situations for longer periods of time in Iraq or Afghanistan or even Libya this year. But I think whatever situation that we're in, many of us tend to follow a number of just very basic rules. You want to keep a relatively low profile. You want to find a safe place to spend the night. And when you go out during the day talking to people, you know who you're going to see. You go and see them, and you go away again. If it's a particularly dangerous area, you don't dawdle, you don't linger. And you depend on that low profile and kind of modesty to protect you. And there's another thing that protects you, too, and it's just that people are hospitable. Most people, even in a terribly dangerous area, are not threatening, and in fact, they'll look after you.
Do you go with a translator? Do you speak the language? What do you do about that?
I've studied Urdu, as my tutor will tell me. I haven't done all that well. and even if I had, it would only get me so far. I mean, English is widely spoken in certain classes in Karachi, and it's seen as a passkey to the global economy. Urdu is the closest thing to a universal language, but there are several other major languages in that city and in that country. You need an interpreter to get you to Pashto or to get you to Sindhi or Punjabi or any number of other languages, or there will be people who you cannot communicate with that well. It's really one of the great difficulties of that country. It's a multilingual nation that I think struggles to communicate with itself.
You mentioned the fact that it doesn't seem to have a I don't know, functioning government is exactly the right word to use, but clearly there's need for more governmental control. Do you think there's the will or even the system to create a more functioning government?
Well, I mean, there's interest in it all the time. I'm actually working on writing something about this. I mean, we have all this debate about the role of government in this country. Right. It may be instructive to look at a place that doesn't have one, or that doesn't seem to have one sometimes. Karachi is a place where even people who've been in the government will say it's been misgoverned for decades, that there have been periods where the city government has gotten very little done. And the city seems quite often to be at war with itself rather than building infrastructure. Now, there have been exceptions. I mentioned that mayor during his administration, a lot of interesting things were built. In fact, a couple of years before that, things began to change and improve. There is an effort from time to time, but millions of people, and this is true in a lot of the developing world, Marty, millions of people are left on their own. They're in these unauthorized neighborhoods. They're not assured of even having sewers. In parts of Karachi, people have organized to dig their own. They're not assured of electric power. In parts of Karachi, people will hook up illegally to the nearest power lines. But of course, it's a power grid that itself collapses regularly, and there are blackouts every single day in the city and across Pakistan. And so you have another one of these contrasts, another one of these fault lines, this city that is wired to the global economy in many ways, where people are reaching for the global economy in many ways, but they sometimes leap back and forth between the 21st century and about the 19th or the 18th, because they keep going from being connected on the internet or on a cell phone to not even having running water or a bit of electricity.
Will you be going back to Karachi? Do you feel like a connection to this city?
I feel some connection to the city, and I've made friends there, and I do hope to go back and continue to follow it. It's been rewarding to just linger in a place for a little while, especially at this moment when history is flying so quickly. I mean, especially this year. I mean, it's been hard for all of us as journalists just to keep up with the developments of the last several years. But I feel that I have begun to understand things a little bit better by staying in a place and going back again and looking around.
You write about a number of people in this book, including a woman named Fatima Bhutto.
Yes, Fatima Bhutto.
Yes.
Yeah, she's a celebrity of sorts. Her grandfather was prime minister of Pakistan. Her aunt Benazir was prime minister also. She didn't get along with her aunt Benazir for a variety of reasons. She actually blamed Benazir for the murder of her father. Uh-huh. But she's become a journalist and a kind of celebrity, if that's the proper word, in Pakistan. And she's one of quite a number of people that you will run across who are eloquent and forceful and struggling, I think, for the right position to take at a gravely difficult time for their country.
And you see women who are covered up and women who are not?
You see both. I mean, you could talk about Fatima Bhutto, or we could talk about Dr. Seemon Jamali, the head of that emergency department I mentioned, who she'll dress modestly, of course, but she doesn't feel the need to wear the complete covering that you would see in some other conservative parts of Pakistan or even some other conservative neighborhoods. The role of women is really interesting in a place like this because there is a variety of roles available to them, depending on their family background, depending to some degree on their personal preference, depending on their income level and their education. They can be very, very conservative or compelled to be very, very conservative, or they can have the opportunity to go to university, to study abroad, to come back again, to become lawyers or become doctors or people in senior positions.
We're almost up on our second break here, but do you see then, when you look into your crystal ball and you look into the future, I mean, do you see more of these so-called instant cities or these instant cities, as you call them?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, that's the way the demographics seem to be heading. And, I, as a journalist, I avoid writing too much in the future tense. But
right,
there are
exactly.
A couple dozen mega cities now. And I think there was maybe one at the end of World War II, mega cities being cities of more than 10 million people. And the United Nations is projecting the urban population of the world to grow, not just from mega cities, but smaller cities as well, villages that become cities of 2 or 3 or 5 million. And there are such places in Pakistan, there are such places in China and India and in much of the developing world. We have become an urban species, and that doesn't seem likely to change anytime soon.
And that's Steve Inskeep, our guest today on Radio Times, author of a new book called Instant City, Life and Death in Karachi. We're going to take a very short break and then talk a little bit about some of the work that he's been doing at NPR. He is co-host of Morning Edition, and we'll get some callers in on the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
3GreatSchools.org supports WHYY. The Haverford School, the Agnes Irwin School, and the Baldwin School. This mainline trio of single-sex college preparatory day schools are dedicated to leveraging what other schools cannot, the distinct ways boys and girls think and learn. Open house dates from October 23rd through November 2nd. Details at 3GreatSchools.org. 3 Great Schools, leading the way in single-sex education.
This time of year, the scarier the better. Frightening movies and attractions, gory Halloween decorations. But what's really happening in our brains when we get scared? And why do some people find that pleasurable while others find it just plain scary? I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, The Lure of Scary Things. That's today at noon, right here on WHYY-FM.
Supporting WHYY, Arden Theater Company presents The Whipping Man on the Arcadia Stage, October 27 through December 18th. A Jewish Confederate soldier returns to his home, reuniting with his family's former slaves. Amidst the rubble from the Civil War, these three men gather to create order, honor their shared faith, and celebrate newfound freedom on Passover. Philadelphia actors Johnny Hobbs Jr. and James Iams perform in this universal story of legacy and redemption. 215-922-1122 or ardentheater.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Steve Inskeep. He's been with NPR for about 15 years now, has covered the Pentagon, the Senate, and the 2000 presidential race. He co-hosted a series of conversations about race called the York Project. It was actually with some 15 Pennsylvanians, and that was during the 2008 presidential campaign. He has covered the Afghan and Iraq wars and the hunt for Al-Qaeda in Pakistan, and his new book is about the sprawling and unruly city of Karachi, home to some 13 million Pakistanis, and it's called Instant City. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get a caller in, and then I do want to talk about what you do at NPR, Stephen.
Sure.
Skeep. Let me get Robert from Skipback to join our conversation. And Robert, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I was in the military for a number of years, and I traveled in the Orient, and I first time there was in 57, and the last time I was there was in 97. Now, cities like Hong Kong and Tokyo and Singapore, they're growing straight up. They're crowded cities, but there's no violence. Why do you think there's so much violence in the Muslim countries? I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Robert. And Steve, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Robert. I don't know if that's an exclusively Muslim thing. I mean, I've spent time in Nigeria where there are chaotic cities, and there's a large Muslim population, but also a large Christian population in Nigeria. I do think that there is a distinction to be drawn, though, between cities that succeed in maintaining some kind of basic law and order and cities that do not. You mentioned Hong Kong. I actually make some comparisons relating to Hong Kong in this book, Robert, because Hong Kong is also a city that in the 1940s got a massive number of refugees, in their case from communist China, and had thousands of people living in refugee camps and continued to grow as an industrializing city, and certainly has problems, corruption or whatever, but has maintained basic law and order, found a way to house people, to come up with a housing program that functioned, and managed some kind of relationship with this giant nation, China, next door. Of course, Karachi is part of a country that has struggled with law and order, that has had a series of military coups that has forced the government basically to start over again every few years. First, a dictator comes in and starts everything over again. Then a democratic government comes in and starts everything over again. And they've had difficult relationships and repeated wars with the giant nation near them, India. And that has distracted from the effort to build basic institutions. You realize how lucky you are just to have quiet, just to have stability, just to have even a rather boring government, if you will, that allows room for people to work to build their own lives and allows an opportunity to build infrastructure and build an economy. And there are cities that have succeeded phenomenally, almost unbelievably, in the last half century or so as the economy has become more global. But there are also cities that have struggled to grab those opportunities.
Robert, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. Steve, let me talk a little bit about you. When did you start working for NPR?
I first came to NPR in 1996. I had done some freelancing before then. When you said a minute ago, I've been there for 15 years. I mean, I was a little shocked.
Is that true?
It is true, right? It is absolutely true. And I guess it just doesn't seem like that long. It seems like I'm still one of the new guys.
Well, were you a print guy before you were a radio guy?
Well, no, not really. I mean, I was doing radio in high school at my high school radio station, and in college at Morehead State University in Kentucky, I worked for a public radio station and also a commercial station as a sportscaster. I was a color guy for high school basketball and football games and loved it. I mean, loved radio. I did some print along the way. I've freelanced for various people, but I've never been a full-time print guy.
And have you always had this voice?
I don't know. There are people who say that my voice has changed when they listen to old tapes, and it may just be that I'm more tired now. Or, you know, it may be something else. It may be that I'm a little more relaxed. You know, maybe I have a little more fun than I used to.
Well, I've been doing this for a while as well, and when I hear old tapes of myself, I sound closer to Minnie Mouse than I do now. I mean,
oh, my goodness. You know. Well, you've got a wonderful voice.
Oh, well, thank you.
But it was great
But are you, doing the gig that you do, what time do you get up in the morning? I know you've been asked this 1,000 times.
It's okay. It's okay. I'm happy to talk about it. I get up at 2:40 in the morning.
Oh, wow.
I get into work around 3:45 Eastern time, give or take, when I'm in Washington, D.C. And I can't complain about it for 1 second because my co-host, Renee Montaigne, does the exact same thing in Southern California, meaning she does it 3 hours earlier. So, you know, there are lots of people who work odd hours for a job, but I'm lucky to have a job that's really fun to come in for.
Sure. So what time do you actually go to sleep then?
Sleep? Oh, okay, fine.
And that's why your voice sounds the way it does, right?
Maybe it is. No, I mean, in theory, I try to go to bed at 7:45 and get about 7 hours of sleep. I've got a small daughter. She's 6 and a half, and I read to her at the end of the night. But it's getting to the point where she wants to stay up later than 7:45, so we may have to figure out some newer arrangement as we go along.
People that have listened to you, and I would include myself in this, have been very moved by the relationship and the interviews that you've done with the Bordelon family from New Orleans, who were hit so hard by Hurricane Katrina. And first of all, they seem like such a wonderful couple, but there seems like such a good chemistry between the three of you.
Well, thank you. There certainly was. We found them in 2005, a short time after the floodwaters had receded. They're in St. Bernard Parish, just outside of New Orleans. And they'd spent their time, people will know the story, some of them spent their time in the house, even though the first floor was flooded. They stayed on the second floor, refused to go anywhere, had a boat tied up by the window, and were determined to stay, even though so many of their neighbors had left. And, you know, in more than a dozen interviews, I believe, up until the time that Donald died in 2010, they were moving. They would be sad. They would tell a joke. They would laugh at the beginning of a sentence and cry at the end. And I did relate to them. I mean, just because they tried so hard. We've continued now and again to talk with Colleen after Donald's death. But, you know, I mean, when Donald died, I felt like a relative had died. It really was, you know, but I don't know. Maybe that's just me. But you know, I get to know in some way. I get to relate to a lot of the people that we interview, and especially the ones who aren't necessarily public officials or famous names. I mean, they're great to talk with, too.
Sure.
But I think it's when you meet someone like the Bordelons that you have a really special conversation.
And you actually care about them. I don't mean, you know, in a way that you might not care about, you know, a senator.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, we all care about our senators, but I noticed that their approval rate is below 10% now.
Something
the Bordelon's
like that.
Probably at a higher approval rate.
I'm probably closer to 99%. And again, Steve Inskeep, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, we are talking about his job at NPR, and we've been talking about a book that he's written about Karachi called Instant City. And we do have some open lines at 1-888-477-9499. This goes back to 2008, but you and Michelle Norris, a co-host of The York Project. This was a series of conversations that you had in York, Pennsylvania, talking about this tough issue of race. What was your interest in that particular project?
Michelle asked me. It was her idea, and it was a great idea. And she wanted the two of us to question a room full of people about race at this charged moment when an African-American was running for the White House. And my first question was, why do you need me? You can do that. But she thought that it would be powerful and different to have a black and a white host do it. And I got excited about it, and we did do a series of conversations in York. There's another example of just going back and going mm-hmm. back to people you might hit once, and we talked with them several times and just listened. And I've been gratified by the response to this. People still ask about it years later, and I think that it's changed both of us in different ways. Michelle ended up writing a book that dealt with racial issues, and I think that even this book that I've written was influenced by it, because I was thinking about diversity. I was thinking about how people get along or how they don't, and how people assume an identity or how they don't, and how they relate to other people.
Well, and one, this may be a tired old question, but one of the problems, I guess, of talking about race is that it's hard for people to talk about. But yeah. I wonder whether over time that proved to be false.
Well, people did end up having a lot to say. We expected to spend a lot of time in that room in York, Pennsylvania with people who were inhibited.
Right.
We spent about 5 minutes. And then somebody said something about dreadlocks in the workplace. And immediately the issue was concrete and the issue was joined. And the discussion only became more intense from there. It's really more a question of how do you get started in this discussion in a safe place?
And the safe place, in certain ways, is defined by the people that lead a group like that, but obviously the participants as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, people gave each other permission to talk. And there were, if you recall that series, I mean, there
sure.
were some pretty outrageous things that
sure.
were said in that room. And you could look around at the faces of other people who were struggling mightily to first let the other person finish, much as they'd like to interrupt them, and second, trying really hard to just understand where they're coming from and then explain why their point of view was different. It was hard work, I think, to have a civil discussion, but people managed it.
Well, let me talk about your day today. As you said, you got up at 2:40.
Yes.
And you arrived at NPR about 3:45.
Yes.
What's the first thing you did this morning when you got to work?
Okay, well, I get in the door and we're looking at the program, and I am rejoining a 24-hour stream of thought. We have a pretty much 24-hour staff, except for a little period on the weekends. And so it's a 24-hour evolution of the show that you hear when you get up in the morning. And I'm involved in that during the day. Then I go away and other people are taking over. And we're trying to get the best idea of what is happening today that you need to know, and also just thoughtful bits of the world from different parts of the world. And that changes all night long. We may make one more change when I show up, or several more. It just depends on the day. And then even after the show goes on the air at 5 a.m., we'll keep making changes, adding and subtracting things all the way through until noon Eastern time, when we go off the air on the Pacific coast. So it's this great improvisation, and the improvising to me has gotten to be the most fun, thinking on your feet.
By that I mean doing live interviews or changing the show or changing a story in the middle of the show, that kind of improv.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, just trying to figure out how to be on top of the news. I'm thinking of the day in February when it looked like Hosni Mubarak was going to fall in Egypt, but he hadn't. And all morning long, we had live updates from different parts of Cairo. And then at 11:05 Eastern, which is just, you know, 8:05 on the West Coast, we got word that Mubarak had fallen. And I stood up, I walked into the studio, and we did 2 hours of live coverage. We continued past noon to 1:00 Eastern. And we were just getting comments from all over the world and the best information we could from all over the world. So, I mean, sometimes there's a quiet holiday. And that can be an opportunity to get a very different kind of thoughtful discussion on the air. We'll talk with a writer. We'll talk with someone who migrated, who's an immigrant to the United States, about the immigrant experience. And sometimes there are earth-shattering events, especially the last few years, again and again and again, and you want to absolutely be on top of them no matter what you have to do.
Do you find yourself exhausted by just the amount of sheer news in the world today?
Oh, it has been unbelievable this year, and you have to discipline yourself. You have to let go, give up, and go home and see the family and try when you can to shut off the smartphone. I mean, I'm active on Twitter.
I was wondering about that. Yeah.
I mean, go ahead. I'm active. I'm always reading things. I get a lot of news from Twitter because people send links. I believe I deliver some news from Twitter because I pass them on to people who are kind enough to follow me. And that I think is a great tool for staying informed. But now and again, I have to just force myself to shove it away. You don't even want the phone in your pocket. You need it to be like plugged in, you know, off in a room somewhere by your bed or just away from you, because it's like it's an addiction, and you need to give your brain some rest.
And you need a straitjacket so you don't go out there and get that phone, right?
It hasn't gotten that bad, but maybe someday.
And do you save a special place in your heart for sports, since you said you did play-by-play?
Yeah. I don't have the time to follow sports the way that I used to and the way that I would love to. But, yeah, I mean, I pay attention to the Colts.
Do you? I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Well, I believe they're 0-8.
Oh, they are. Okay.
They lost yesterday. And it's just that they're on their way to a first draft pick, though. And so they're...
There's hope, right?
Well, yes, there is hope. Yeah. There's a phrase, which I won't repeat on this family radio program, about the hope that the Colts will get luck. But anyway.
And about a minute here. But, I mean, obviously you co-host Morning Edition, but you also have these forays, you know, outside the studio. And I'm assuming that's a good balance for you?
It is really hard, but it's the only way that I would do this job or
really?
That I could see myself do. I mean, that was a condition of the job. I want to report. I want to see things for myself. And everybody at NPR totally agreed. It wasn't like I had to fight very hard for this. And Renee Montaigne is the same way. I mean, you go out and you try to learn everything that you can and see everything that you can. And you try to get a look at news stories you think will be stories for a long time. So that when you come back here to the studios and you're doing an interview, maybe you are able to do a smarter interview. It's harder for someone to put one over on you or get something wrong because you've been there and you've seen things yourself. I think that is getting to be a rarity in journalism, is just going and looking at things and bearing witness to what's happening in the world. There's so much analysis, there's so much talk, but there is not as much as there needs to be actual reporting on what real people are doing in the world. So any excuse that I can get, I will do that.
Steve Inskeep, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Oh, it was a great honor. Thank you very much.
Well, you're very welcome. And the book is called Instant City, Life and Death in Karachi. And he is co-host of NPR's Morning Edition. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, and it's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.